Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. On the heels of the Israeli elections and the ongoing negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program, what's next in the Middle East? Well, that's the focus for the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, as Middle Eastern Security Specialist Brian Katula spoke. Katula is my guest today. He's a senior fellow on national security policy and on the Middle East and South Asia for the Center for American Progress. He's been a consultant to a number of U.S. government agencies, private corporations, and non-governmental organizations throughout the Middle East. From 1995 to 1998, he lived and worked in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Egypt for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. He writes frequently on Middle Eastern policy for the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Wire of the Wall Street Journal. And he was a Fulbright Scholar in 1994 and 95 in Amman, Jordan, where he conducted research on the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Brian Katulis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Rich.
You're speaking on the U.S. challenges in the Middle East, and frankly, where do you begin?
Well, every day is a different problem, but I think where we begin is the issue of Iran for a number of reasons. First, it's front and center in negotiations, which essentially have been going on for years. The negotiations the Obama administration is leading on, built on a framework that the Bush administration started years ago. And it looks like we're getting to a point where we'll either have a better sense of a deal or no deal. They're driving for a political framework at the end of this month with the hope of getting a full deal to lock down Iran's nuclear program with monitoring and verification. But that is, I think, essential, because if we don't get a deal here, there's a real likely prospect that not only Iran goes closer to a nuclear weapon, but then perhaps the rest of the region too.
And what's really become apparent in the last few years is that Iran is really the one, if not the major regional power. It's very close to being the top major regional power in the area.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I talked about last night, which is this issue of the multiple centers of power. But Iran clearly has been on the rise, and I would say especially since the 2003 Iraq War. Before that war, we had the United States a strategy of what was called dual containment, containing Iraq under Saddam Hussein and then Iran. And one of the strategic consequences of actually going into Iraq, and I know it's been a sharp debate here, but the reality is that Iran has seen its influence spread westward, not only into Iraq, but then also in Syria and into Lebanon with Hezbollah. Part of that was when you eliminate a dictator like Saddam Hussein, and he was awful to his people, but it just changed the structure of the region overall. So Iran really has been on the rise.
Was that something we would acknowledge going into Iraq in the first place?
If you look back at the record, I don't think it was thought through in that way. If you look back on the multiple justifications for the war, I mean, first was sort of the notion that Saddam had nuclear weapons and the intelligence wasn't accurate or was misused or whatever. Then there was this notion of the war would actually lead to tsunamis of democracy in the Middle East, and that it would somehow lead to sort of a creation of a new order, a new democratic liberal world order. And that didn't work out very well as much. So Iran, it's one of those things that I think we should have known. And what's interesting is that when you look at what we've done over the last decade or so, not only did we get rid of Saddam Hussein, which is a major enemy of Iran, we got rid of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which was also against Iran. And then today, flash forward to 2015, we have U.S. troops back in Iraq fighting in concert with many of the pro-Iranian or even in some cases Iranian officials going after ISIS.
Yeah, no, and certainly we know the Israeli reaction to all this, but what about the other allies in the region? Are they comfortable with an ascendant Iran?
Absolutely not. And look, over the last 5 or 6 years, the United States has sold a record number of weapons to countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. And here I'm talking upwards of $100 billion, which dwarf anything we've done with Israel or even Egypt. And a large part of that is, A, they've got the money, but then, B, these countries have a sense of a threat from Iran. And so they're not very comfortable at all. And I think It'll be interesting to see if we get a nuclear deal, because the Saudis have already visibly protested the fact that we're even trying to do this.
Well, I read one account recently which likened those Gulf states as thinking they were in a monogamous relationship with the United States, and all of a sudden they found out they were in an open relationship because we're talking to Iran and trying to get this deal out of Iran.
Yeah, and I mean, in my view, I understand their perspective, but if you really want to have the best chance and the most effective way of locking down Iran's nuclear program, you've got to try this first and foremost. And there was a deal struck in late 2013, an interim deal, that actually gave us more access, more information, and knowledge of what they've been up to. And I think that is much more effective and less costly than any other alternative means that people have proposed, including going to war with Iran.
Now, in the last Iranian administration, there was a sense that we will never give up our nuclear program. Today, it's a more opaque message, if you will. It's difficult to discern whether they really and truly would give up that program. What is your sense?
My sense is that they probably still will want to maintain some sort of domestic enrichment, and they say it's for energy and not for weapons. But I doubt that they would give up all of it. And some of the proposals by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, he came to Washington a few weeks ago, and he actually adapted his position slightly as well. He used to say zero enrichment for Iran in the country, and he actually didn't say that on this speech. And few journalists noted this, a few analysts noted this, but there was a slight shift there. So I think most pragmatists understand, and I think the international consensus that has developed is that Iran is likely to have some sort of infrastructure in place. The key is actually having enough monitoring and verification mechanisms, having enough eyes and ears to make sure that what they're doing is purely for generating electricity and energy and not for developing a weapon.
Is there a deal that you think that the Netanyahu government can accept, other than totally giving up nuclear program completely?
I think so, but we'll have to wait and see. And this is why the next couple of weeks into the end of June are really a delicate moment, because I think these talks have been extended for a while. But I think, and I've spoken to some of the U.S. negotiators that are at the table with the Iranians recently, and they, I think, are not naive about the prospects. They don't oversell it, but they also see it as there's a window here. And I think, you know, Israel is so heavily dependent on the U.S. and its security umbrella, even though Prime Minister Netanyahu was making his arguments a few weeks ago. I think it's going to be hard for them to do anything that is different from what the U.S. actually and the P5 plus one, the international consensus is.
In those talks with Iran, we have President Rouhani on one side. We have the Ayatollah and the mullahs that sort of are the supreme leaders.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of who we're talking and negotiating with and whether we'll pass muster in both sides of their government?
You know, and I would add to that equation, you also have the Iranian people who
probably want a deal.
They want a deal.
They want normalized relationships.
And what's interesting is when you look at sort of measures of popular sentiment across the Middle East, the most pro-American at the popular level is actually Iran. And it's in part because what I think there's likely to be a generational change. I wouldn't predict when, but at some point in the next decade or so, there's a new generation that has grown up under what has been restrictive sanctions and a bad sort of closed religious society, and they want something different. You know, the leadership structures inside of Iran are quite opaque, but there is a supreme leader, and it comes down to whether he gives his nod to this or not. He's given mixed signals publicly about this. And I think the fact that they're at the table, though, is a function of the fact that we've put pressure on them through sanctions. They're hurting. And, you know, time will tell. I think it's just too difficult to predict.
How have the lowered oil prices hurt Iran? Because I know they have official sanctions against the selling of oil, but
yeah,
they have probably been selling oil surreptitiously.
Yeah, it's hurt them tremendously. In addition to the sanctions, you know, everybody I think knows very well. I mean, when you go to the gas pump, the price of oil has dropped more than half, and it's hurt countries like Iran in addition to Russia. And that is in part a result of our increased production, but then also a part of Saudi Arabia, which we were just talking about. Saudi Arabia, I think largely because it wanted to maintain market share and for mostly financial and economic reasons, have expanded their production. But I also think they're looking across the Persian Gulf and they're looking at if there is a deal and Iran unleashes, again, it comes back to market share. And it's an interesting bet that they're making because they're actually Saudi Arabia is hurting as well with the lower oil prices. But I think they have their eye to the long run about the prospects that Iran may actually rejoin the international community.
Well, let's shift out of Iran to our relationship with Israel, which has been, I can't remember when U.S.-Israeli relationships were at least from the surface looking like they're pretty bad.
Yes.
The relationship between the Obama administration and Netanyahu, he's now won re-election. What should we make from that re-election? Because looking at polls a week or two ago, his party did not look all that strong. Was it his statement on the election eve that he would not accept a two-state solution? I mean, he categorically ruled that out. How important was that in his election?
I think it was important for activating his base in the Israeli right. The interesting thing for me, and the dust still needs to settle not only on the election results, but then in Israel, it's the coalition building process. And I think
there's no 100% certainty that he's going to form a government because he has to have coalition partners.
But he's in a stronger position than I think many analysts believed he would be because they thought, okay, he might be damaged. He's got challenges from the center left. And what the elections earlier this week demonstrate is that he's in a fairly strong position. He made these appeals not only against a two-state solution, but then I think went hard right in terms of how he talked about even citizens of his own country, the Arab Israelis who have Israeli citizenship. What's interesting to me is that he's got about 25% of the vote, his party did. It's not a sweeping mandate. Whatever coalition he pulls together, the overall result inside of Israel is, in essence, not all that different than previous elections. It's a very divided society. And I think it would be a mistake to overread his becoming a prime minister for the fourth time, which is history. Yeah, it's history. But I think he'll be very constrained by not only his coalition, but on these issues of Iran and on the Israeli-Palestinian front. I think his hand is not as strong as I think the election results seem.
Hmm. And what about our relationship with them? Certainly from a personal level, the two leaders don't get along at this point.
Yeah, the chemistry between the two of them is really bad. But I think, and I was in Israel last month. I used to live over there and I go regularly. I think in a Middle East that's changing so much where the United States needs as many reliable and capable partners, we need to move beyond sort of these political fights. And what I think has been unfortunate over the last 4 or 5 years has been this effort in Israel, but then also in our country, and trying to make the U.S.-Israel relationship a partisan wedge issue in our politics and in their politics. And I actually think that's bad for America, and it's bad for the U.S. It's bad for America because, again, with Egypt looking a little bit shaky, uncertainty always about other partners like Turkey, which is a NATO ally, but it has its own turmoil. Israel is one of those few places where our intelligence agencies, our militaries could go to those guys and say, hey, we need to do X, Y, and Z. Let's work together on this. And you could be fairly certain that that would happen. Israel needs us. So there's strategic interests. You know, Israel's increasingly isolated in the region and it's seen sort of more opposition in terms of its stances from Europe and other places. So there's a marriage of interests that could be had here, and I think we need to move beyond these personal fights.
At the time of Netanyahu's visit, you had a piece that sort of outlined the step to revitalize this relationship. What are some of those things?
Well, first, and we were talking about the Iran nuclear deal. We definitely need to work with Israel, and we, you know, our negotiators have done this. They've briefed them in, but we need to not have any surprises coming either way. And whenever a deal, if it looks like it's coming down the pike, they need to be briefed on it. If they have security concerns about that deal, if there is a deal, we need to actually figure out ways to work with them. The second thing is on counterterrorism, and we often forget this, but just right across the border from Israel, and I was there in early February, you can see al-Qaeda fighting Assad, al-Qaeda's affiliate inside of Syria, and it's right there. It's like two, three miles from Israel's border. The wars in Gaza. We need to work on counterterrorism. We've been doing that quite well, but we need to continue that. And then lastly, on the Israeli-Palestinian front, And this will be difficult, given what Prime Minister Netanyahu said about a no two-state solution. But we do need to figure out if there's a way to get back to ways to build trust between the Israelis and Palestinians, because if that blows up again at a time of turmoil in Syria, uncertainty in Egypt, that's the last thing we need, is another fire to put out.
My guest today is Brian Katulis, a senior fellow on national security for the Middle East at the Center for American Progress. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you just go from hotspot to hotspot. You mentioned Syria just across Israel's border as seeing al-Qaeda fighting the Assad government. You have, we've heard recently on Morning Edition, just this poignant story of a household that's been under siege for at least a couple of years, and the horrible, horrible nature of this conflict in Syria. And there just doesn't seem to be any sort of solution at this particular point.
Yeah, the Syrian civil war, which this month reaches its fourth year, fourth anniversary, is heading into its fifth year, has become the vortex for the region. All of these different forces being sucked in from the outside.
Saw the birth of ISIS.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is largely the product of this hot war within the region between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, which we talked about earlier. But it's also a fight between many of the Sunni majority countries. So the Syrian opposition, the reason, large part, the anti-Assad opposition, large part why it's fractured is that you had different oil-rich, wealthy countries investing in different aspects of the Syrian opposition. Qatar funding one part, Saudi Arabia another part, and again, this vortex, something that was the regional tensions being sucked into it. And the tragedy of Syria is that you've got, you know, more than 200,000 people dead now. You've got 9 million plus displaced, and many of them outside of the country. And it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight.
Mm. Now, let's talk a little bit about ISIS. Seems like ISIS is no longer advancing. You have Shiite militias backed by Iran actually trying to force ISIS out of Tikrit, which is a Sunni stronghold. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what happened last summer in the blitzkrieg of ISIS into the heart of parts of Iraq, for every action, there's a reaction. And what we've seen is not only the Shia-led government in Baghdad, but then the Kurds. I was in Erbil in November of last year, which is the Kurdish capital in northern Iraq. You have Kurdish Peshmerga fighting back. And not only are they fighting back, what's interesting, I think that ISIS is probably, it seems strong now, but I think it's going to actually be defeated. And I think the real risk inside of Iraq is not how long does ISIS hold territory, but what will be the consequences of the reactions of different actors. So as you mentioned, Tikrit, this was Saddam Hussein's hometown, and I was there in 2003 briefly, and it's largely a Sunni area. And now it's been, in essence, invaded by a lot of these Shia militias and Iranians backing this as well. So what happens next? Does Iraq actually hold together? Similarly, in Kirkuk, which is north of Tikrit, you've seen the Kurdish forces go in, and this is a disputed area. So to me, you know, yes, ISIS is a threat. It needs to be contained. But how we and others react to it, much like I think how we reacted to al-Qaeda after the 9/11 attacks. They were a threat, but if you overreact or if you don't think through all of your steps, you could actually end up either overreaching or making strategic errors that make the situation worse. And I think that's a danger inside of Iraq.
Would you say that's something ISIS has done with this public beheading regimen? You saw how Jordan reacted when one of their members of the Air Force was beheaded. Obviously, that galvanized people in Jordan. And I think you're seeing just as in Iraq during the days after the invasion, where al-Qaeda overplayed its hands, basically killing more Muslims than Americans, if
yes,
you will. Is the street turning against ISIS?
Yeah, and I think it never really – yes, I think it is, and I don't think it ever really had strong support in those places like Jordan, as you mentioned. It did get some support and took root. And again, those places like Syria, where they felt like the government wasn't addressing their grievances, or in Iraq, it really took fire when the former prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq, did not sort of include Sunnis in that process. So that's why I think it's not only what we do militarily. I think military action is important, and we need to actually defeat some of these forces. You won't be able to negotiate with them. But then after they're defeated, what sort of political arrangement did we learn, or did the Iraqis learn, more importantly, from their own experiences?
Say the Kurds in the north, will we be able to constrain them from basically acting on their territorial impulses? They want Mosul and that area?
Yeah, it'll be really hard, I think, to do that. But I think the one thing that is leverage against them, because I think separatism right now and creating new countries in the Middle East is not the solution. Some people say, oh, well, you know, Sykes-Picot, the old colonial agreements that actually created these countries,
yes,
is irrelevant. I think that's right as an observation. I actually think it's wrong as a policy recommendation, because I think the one thing that keeps the Kurds in Iraq's federal system is their dependence on oil. And they don't actually have enough oil or oil resources to run their government. Basra and the southern part of Iraq actually have more of the resources. So there's a certain dependency on the center that I think will make at least Iraq hang together. Syria, it's still unclear. It looks like there's different battle lines that may be settling, but it's still too early, I think, in the conflict, unfortunately, to tell.
Well, let's talk about another country out of the Arab Spring where it seems to be bifurcated, and that's Libya.
Yeah.
Where you have two almost rival governments vying for power, one in the east, one in the west.
Well, in some ways, it's that, I think, would be simple if it was. It's more complex than that, because what you have is the militarization of the country, the creation of different militias.
Yeah, plus almost a warlord situation where a neighborhood has got a commander.
Yeah, that's right. And look, you know, Muammar Gaddafi, the previous leader of Libya, was an awful dictator. But he did keep sort of these differences together under one framework. And now it's much more complicated. And I think the fact that groups like ISIS, which have appeared now in Libya as well, an affiliate of it, the sort of chaos that we've seen in Libya, and I served on a UN panel on Libya from 2013 to 2014 that was looking at the situation there. And it's not surprising to me that we are where we are, because in 2011 we went in. We eliminated the head of the government and any systems to keep order. And then there wasn't any follow-up plan. And it has echoes of what happened in Iraq too, even though in Iraq we had a large troop presence. This chaos that ensued, and then extremist groups sort of fill the gap. The danger in Libya is not only what it will do to Libya, but how it could spread next door, and it has already spread next door to Egypt, which is the largest, most populous country in the Middle East. And sort of the threats that we've seen migrate over the last couple of years are really worrisome.
And that threat is exacerbated by the fact that we're not really sure how to deal with Egypt. They've had the military coup. We didn't like the Muslim Brotherhood government. When that was overthrown, we didn't like the fact that it was overthrown instead of voted out.
Yes.
And so we're kind of at a situation where we really don't know what to do with Egypt either.
Yeah, we've been in a sense of paralysis. I mean, the U.S. still maintains some military assistance to Egypt and some economic assistance. And, you know, I went to Egypt. I used to live there. I went to Egypt in October. We put out a report, which is on our website at AmericanProgress.org, on Egypt in January. And it tries to offer a picture of what's happening inside of Egypt, and then what should America do about it. And in a sense, our policy has been stuck on autopilot. We've held back some assistance because we didn't like the way the current president had come into power in a military coup. But we really aren't as much of a factor as those actors in the region. Over the last 2 years, and if you include a recent economic conference Egypt had last weekend, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and others have given more than $30 billion of aid to Egypt, $30 billion, which is more than what the U.S. has given in terms of in the last decade in military assistance. So it just shows you, like, that statistic in this fight over Egypt is that you've got forces within the region that are wealthy, that have an interest, and they're playing this game. It's sort of like a new Arab Cold War, if you will. And Egypt is a centerpiece of the struggle in ways that even Iraq or Syria isn't, because it is so large and such an important factor.
There's been a growing, emerging body of thought that says, you know, this is how it's going to eventually be solved, that the players in the region are going to have to solve the problem.
Yeah.
What is the role of the United States?
Well, look, the U.S. actually has more assets in the region than any other outside power. Russia or China is not a rival. I mean, you'll have from time to time, like, President Putin of Russia going to Egypt recently, and they make a big show of it. But in terms of the amount of ties that he has, the security cooperation that he has with Egypt, it's nothing compared to what the U.S. still maintains. Our network includes not only Israel and Turkey and Egypt, but it's got a bunch of Gulf countries that don't like each other, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and others. And it really is expansive. We're sort of the security underwriter of the region. And yes, we can't solve the civil wars. And I think it would be foolish for us to get back in the middle of civil wars, like when we were back in the middle of Iraq's civil war. But the one thing we can do is to continue to maintain sort of the region's overall access to sea and commerce and a basic sense of stability. I go to the Middle East at least once a month. And I'm picky about where I go, but I generally don't feel unsafe because there's a security umbrella that is largely being provided by us. I actually think it's in our interest to maintain that for reasons of our own sort of interests and for security. But when it comes to the politics of the region, I think we need to be very modest and understand that some of these fights really need to kind of play out to an equilibrium by themselves. I mean, I think there are things that we can do better, as we did in Iraq last year. We reengaged in Iraq in a way that forced the Iraqi government to bring more Sunnis into the government. You can work on the margins like that to actually produce what could be meaningful results. But we need to remind ourselves constantly that we cannot completely control events. We can help shape and influence, but we need to be very sort of circumspect about any delusions that we're going to, again, have democracies and tsunamis of democracies breaking out in the Middle East.
If leadership does have to develop in the Middle East, who needs to step up in your mind?
Well, the people and the political leaders in particular. You know, the one thing we found in our research, and we did a 5-country study last year looking at a number of different countries in the region, the one gap that is missing, some of these countries have a lot of oil money. Some of them have strong militaries. What they don't have are ideas, political ideas that actually, how do you govern a country in the 21st century? And we can suggest ideas about how they can do that, but part of it has to come back from their developing political leaders and technocrats and economic leaders who have a vision to the future, as opposed to going back 100 or 1,000 years, unfortunately, like a lot of them want to. And I think, again, that has to come from the sense, and you see it in certain places like the United Arab Emirates. They have a much more forward-looking, engaged strategy on energy and green energy and other things. They have the resources to do it. But in other places like Egypt, they're still fumbling along to figure out what is it actually, how do we run a country of 90 million people and have a modern economy?
And I think what you're also saying is they have to move beyond the sectarian and ethnic divides that tend to govern these various states. It's like one group is in power, and that's who's in power instead of power sharing.
That's right. And, you know, I have to be cautious about this as somebody who lives in Washington, D.C., because we have our own brand of sectarian divides,
true,
the left-right, yeah, which has produced some deadlock. But by and large, despite what I think has been in our own system, our political system, a lot of unforced errors, the system still works. Unfortunately, in many parts of the Middle East, it doesn't, because politics is driven by this hardcore identity. You're a Shia Muslim or a Sunni Muslim, and that defines a political agenda. And that's where I think if you look at the Middle East today, it's a cautionary tale for those who like the politics of division in our own country. We definitely need to not go down that path. But the main thing, I think, you need to have, like, I had a friend come with me to the Middle East once who'd never been there before. He said, "Brian, what is center, left, right in these countries?" And I said, "You know what? That's a really important question, because we used to have nationalism, Arab nationalism, and like a very sort of strong sort of identity of I'm an Arab and Gamal Abdel Nasser. You have Islamism, which, again, it has a certain philosophy, but when it comes to ruling a modern society in the 21st century, it hasn't proven its success in any big way. What you definitely need is sort of, you know, a center left and a center right emerging in these places.
All right. Brian Katulis, thanks very much for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow on national security at the Center for American Progress and was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.